the moment that I realized, you know, what had happened and that I was on the back of the bear, the only way I can relate to it is, and I've never been in a car accident, I've hit a deer on a motorcycle doing like 70, and it's probably a second or something, but it lasts, it kind of consumes all that had happened before and consumes any notion of what is going to happen ahead in life. But, you know, it was probably just a matter of a couple of seconds. I can't remember what kind of plants or trees there were, but it was very thick vegetation outside of the meat tree. And I just remember like almost envisioning, you know, being down there getting mauled by this bear. And before that happened, I got bucked off, like just fell off the bear and it kept going. And I popped up and part of the crew had already started to run after me, you know, with their pistols and bear spray. I had like at that point consciously known that I had gotten away with something, that it could have easily gone the other way. And everyone else was fine. But I slammed into an alder bush, and actually it was a hard enough, we were going fast enough, me and old Kodiak, that it was a pretty striking hit, and it hurt. And, you know, later when we got back to camp, I looked and I had my whole side was bruised. But, you know, at the moment, it was like just felt unscathed and just glad to run back amongst the crew and, you know, be prepared for another incident.
I had to go back and preface with when we sat down to have sandwiches. I sat down, I took my pack off. My pack had a pistol strapped to its hip belt. On my actual belt that was still holding my pants up, I had a can of bear spray holstered. So I had two things that were there ready for warding off a bear. But in the moment, and this is where I didn't do much thinking, I just reacted. I remember coming to my feet very quickly. And again, I don't remember the actual motions. I can't remember if I put my hands down on the ground to sort of push myself up off my bottom, or if I got a knee underneath me and then stood up with one leg first and then the other one. I just remember being in like a very comfortable seated position with a sandwich in my hand to all of a sudden standing there. And instead of having a pistol or bear spray in my hand, I was holding two trekking poles. Then I remember thinking, well, I might as well swing. I also remember having the thought of, if I get run over by this bear and it starts to maul me, there's five other people here. Remy Warren had a pistol that he might be able to shoot it with. There's five other people that could also grab a trekking pole and hit it or scare it or something. So I remember thinking it won't last long. Once I got to my feet, I was in a like a batter's position, like someone that's at home plate waiting for the pitcher to throw a ball. Very athletic stance, like as if though I had planned to do this and not spray bear spray at it or shoot it with a pistol, but that my plan all along was just to hop up and try to hit it with trekking poles. So I had them both in one hand kind of clenched together to make one weapon or one kind of stick. It felt as though I just took a swing at a fastball and pretty much right at full extension when the bear was right in front of me, when the bear's head was probably 4 feet from my hips, I contacted the bear's face. The last thing that I thought would happen is what happened, which was that once I made contact, the bear turned about face, not quite 180 degrees, and left our little zone where all of us had been sitting so peacefully just seconds earlier having a sandwich. I was very relieved at that moment. And so instead of like that tunnel vision and having it be only me and the bear in a very intense situation, all of a sudden now it like the world opened up again and there was five people around me and I could just see the sky again. And I could see the ground and everything was there. As everything's coming back to me, I realized that as the bear is leaving, our little hangout zone, there's a person riding on top of the bear. So both Remy Warren and I at that time had drawn pistols, and we had taken, I don't know, two or three steps towards where we saw the bear and the human disappear. And at that moment, that's when Garrett Smith came back up over the roll with eyes as big as I've ever seen. Dinner plates times 10, wide open, kind of hustling back up over this knob.
I remember my first comment when we got back to the circle was like, let's get out of here. And Steve was like, we got to get the meat. Which I think everyone reacted in their own way to the shock. Pat was a really good friend outside of the meat eater shoots, and like we kayaked together and rock climbed together and stuff. And I remember he looked at me in the circle and was starting to get, you know, very noticeably emotional and kind of keyed in on me to like be like, holy shit, man, that was fucked up. And I just was like, Pat, we can't not even talk about it. Let's get out of here. Everyone, so real quick, it kind of went into everyone facing out into the vegetation. And, you know, everyone at that point had a bear spray or a pistol. I think Giannis and Remy had 44 mags, and then the rest of us had bear spray.
After we had done a head count and realized that everybody was safe and with us, the bear circled us one time. At that point in time, we could hear the bear walking through the alders, popping its jaws, clacking its teeth for maybe another minute or two. We had all sort of formed a circle, you know, with our backs facing each other, everybody looking outward, sort of just like watching our perimeter.
And then we finally had our shit together, and people had pistols out, we had spray out, and you could hear the bear come woofing around, woofing back uphill. And now I'm like, we're killing this bear, man. We are going to kill this bear. I don't care what. We're trying to get it through the brush, like to get a chance to kill it. It woofs all the way around from the 6 o'clock to 12 o'clock position, and then it's just gone. Once we put it together that we weren't going to get a chance to kill this bear, at least right away, it was still very much in our mind that it was going to come back. And I wasn't going to leave all that elk meat hanging in that tree. So I climbed up in the tree to start sending down all these quarters. And people kept yelling, hey, bear, which is our thing. But it got confusing because there's too many people saying the word bear, and it's hard to tell if the bear's there or not. So at some point, I remember yelling down that, like, don't say bear. Like, cut the hey bear out. Bear is for when you see the bear. Up until that point, say something different because it's stressing me out. I could tell some people were maybe a little bit alarmed about this, my insistence on retrieving this stuff, but I wasn't going to leave it there. We get it down, get it loaded on backpacks, and then kind of move out in like a rear guard pattern where we had everybody moving with the meat down slope to get clear of the alder and head out. And we had people in the back kind of watching back with pistols.
I remember just kind of reeling in the fact that we were walking out without someone being dead or hurt. But at one point, fairly soon, maybe a couple hours after starting the hike back, we saw another Kodiak. And we hadn't seen any Kodiaks until that day because of the weather. And we saw a Kodiak maybe, I don't know, 400, 600 yards away. And I remember thinking like, oh, that boy is coming after us. Where realistically, like, you know, you're in the mountains and you're in bear country, you see many bears and they have no interest in messing with humans. Within maybe 3 hours, we're sitting around the fire. No one's going to get hypothermia. And just kind of in silence, we're like shocked, but, you know, occasionally would crack up about what had happened. The come down didn't happen till I was back at my home in Montana days later.
The dramatic portion of that story takes place in about the amount of time it takes you to casually stand up out of your chair. Yet what's remarkable about our mutual experience is the extent to which time slowed down to a crawl during the brown bear's charge. Dirtmouth talked about the way time seemed to dissolve while he rode on the bear's back. The event consumed all that had happened before and any notion of what would happen ahead in life. But, somewhat paradoxically, we both also hovered outside of ourselves, in an imagined future where a death from this event had already taken place. Each of us experienced a narrowing of perception to a specific sense. For Dirt, it was touch. While Yanni and I both found our field of vision homing in on the bear's teeth, we can chalk that up to the flood of adrenaline and cortisol caused by sudden high stress, which is part of our innate fight or flight response. It's the same mysterious chemistry that enabled Yanni to rise up, grab his trekking poles, and smack the bear without even stopping to think about it, thereby turning the bear around and putting it on a crash course for Dirt as he was coming around the tree. None of us even saw Yanni swing the trekking poles. And later, we would laugh about the fact that one of our videographers never even saw the bear at all. I think that the reason the story exemplifies close calls so perfectly in my head is that, in those seconds, it was impossible not to imagine things going another way. In the months following that incident, I struggled a bit to make sense of what happened and what didn't happen. I was stuck for a time hovering between two worlds, my normal daily life, and then that life beneath the meat tree, the one in which something bad happened. It prompted an acquaintance of mine to share a story about a close call of his own. He was felling a big cedar tree with a chainsaw, having carefully calculated the fall zone based on the lean of the tree. But just as the tree began to tip, a breeze picked up and stalled it out. For a moment, he couldn't tell which way it was going to go. Then it began to fall the opposite direction it was supposed to. My friend stumbled back and fell and had to make a split-second decision to roll right or roll left. The wrong choice would be death. He chose correctly, and the tree crashed down beside him. He struggled in the following days and began to feel as though his existence had taken on the quality of a dream. He felt as though he was somehow hanging in the balance between life and death. Later, he went back to the tree and bucked it up with his saw. When he rolled the pieces away, he was overcome with an eerie false premonition, the sense that he was going to roll away a piece of the tree and find his own skeleton lying there. And he'd then learn that everything he'd experienced since the fall of the tree was the dream, and the reality was him underneath the tree. The 60-foot fall. Our experience on a fog knack is a good example of the way a couple of poor choices in the wilderness can result in a dramatic outcome. But we court danger every day, in perhaps more relatable ways, through the more mundane and ordinary decisions we make. Now, we'll move to a mountain range in Idaho, where, despite being an experienced hiker, our storyteller made some highly relatable mistakes that led to a serious emergency.
My name is Avery Schaller. I'm currently a grad student at the University of California, Berkeley, studying how elk migrations affect patterns of wolf-livestock conflict. And my fieldwork involves investigating wolf kills in grizzly country, which is a very risky thing to be doing. It's pretty much the opposite of what Wyoming Game and Fish advises people to do in the backcountry, because grizzly bears are attracted to dead things and will fight you for it. In a lot of ways, my experience of my accident has shaped the way I conduct myself in my research. Not only being in charge of myself, but being responsible for the safety of other people has made me set up very strict protocols about safety, and how to manage risk. A lot of fieldwork is focused on gathering the data no matter what. But for me, my priority is keeping my team safe because I know what can go wrong.
Blaine County 911 Federation Emergency. 911, do you have an emergency?
Yes.
What's going on?
I was climbing a mountain that I fell.
How far did you fall?
I don't know, but my leg is torn up and I don't know where I am.
Okay, did you know what mountain it was you're climbing up?
I have a pretty bad depression. I just can't.
Are you by yourself?
Yeah, I don't know where I am.
Okay, so I'll send the phone to you, okay? What's your name?
Avery.
How do you spell that? Are you still there? Hello? Are you still there?
I was living in Ketchum, Idaho, which is surrounded by several mountain ranges, including the Pioneer Mountains. The Pioneer Mountains are one of the more rugged mountain ranges in Idaho, with some peaks above 12,000 feet. It was Labor Day weekend, and I had just done a quick two-day backpacking trip with a friend in a nearby mountain range. I had been thinking about climbing this peak called the Devil's Bedstead. I had already hiked the other prominent peaks in the Pioneers, and the Devil's Bedstead was always there on my mind and thought, might as well do it that Monday. And I think I had asked a couple friends if people were available to hike, and I think other people had other plans. But for me, that wasn't going to be a reason to not do the hike anyways. I had done a lot of solo hiking before, and so the fact that people weren't available wasn't going to stop me from getting out there and having fun. I knew it was going to be just a day hike. It wasn't going to be anything major, so it wasn't like I needed a dawn start. I packed lots of layers because it was early September and it could be really chilly on top. I packed first aid kit. I always hike with a first aid kit. I am trained in wilderness first medicine, having gotten my wilderness first responder and recently had recertified it. And I packed a knife, a headlamp, my lunch, which was leftover pasta, and a couple granola bars and some fruit, just typical things you bring along on a day hike. And I also threw in my emergency satellite beacon, which I used for work. At the time, I was currently working as an independent contractor working for different conservation organizations, doing things from environmental baseline reports to working as a coordinator for a wolf livestock coexistence project, and was often in the field by myself, and so carried that beacon for those solo field work times. I woke up the next morning and saw that there was a dusting of snow in the mountains and thought for a second, oh, maybe I shouldn't go today. But it was a clear, sunny day, and I figured that the snow would melt and decided to go through with it. I left Ketchum and drove east on Trail Creek Road, which is a gravel road that winds up between the Pioneer and White Cloud Mountains. The approach I was taking for the Devil's Bedstead required me to bushwhack through Douglas firs and up a slope to where I would get to the base of the mountain. I made it to the base of the Devil's Bedstead where I could see the different approaches that were laid out before me. One required hiking up to a saddle, which brought you up to a ridge where you could just follow to the summit. And another, which I had read about in a guidebook, required a bit more rock scrambling, but it looked like a fun way to go, and I figured I had the time, and I decided to go for the more fun route. I start up, and there's still a little bit of snow, and it's starting to melt away, and I'm having fun scrambling through the rocks, something that I've done many times. And about an hour in, I slipped because the snow was starting to get a bit icy because the shadow of the mountain was lowering the temperatures on that face. And I cut open my shin, and I remember looking down and thinking, that's going to leave a scar. And so I had to grab my first aid kit and wrap up my leg. And I realized that this wasn't that much fun anymore, and that I needed to just get to a spot and reassess what exactly I wanted to do. I realized that the conditions of the snow had changed. Yes, the snow was melting, but it was also refreezing. And this snowy ice field that I thought was going to melt out and dry out had just become a slick ice field. I realized that it was going to be a difficult situation to navigate. Above where I had just fallen, there was a ledge that looked flat, and I climbed up to it so that I could reassess my situation and just take a break. I grabbed my lunch and ate only half of it because I knew that I might need the rest for later. I attempted to climb off that ledge a couple times to see if there was a good way down, and the rocks were just covered in ice, and so I knew that I was kind of stuck up there. And I really had to seriously consider what my options were, because the priority now wasn't getting to the top. The priority now was trying to stay safe. Now that I knew that going down the way I came was no longer an option, I began to evaluate what else I could do. I pulled out my cell phone and switched it off airplane mode, which I always just kept it on to save battery, and to see if my phone could connect with any bars, but each attempt just said searching. The only other option I could think of was that I had my emergency satellite beacon, which involves mobilizing a whole crew of rescuers. And I wasn't injured, I wasn't in a life-threatening situation, but despite the embarrassment of having to mobilize a whole rescue team, I decided to pull out my beacon and press that SOS button. On this particular device, you have to hold the SOS button for 20 seconds. And so I pressed the button and watched the countdown begin on the screen. 20, 19, 18. And after about 5 seconds, I heard the sound of the device powering down. And at that point, I realized that my situation had become much more dire. I didn't have any way of contacting people to let them know where I was, and it was up to me to get myself out of there. I took out my topo map and looked to see what it would be like to go up instead of back down the way I came, and could see that there was a small steep section which led to a ridge that I could scramble on to get to the easier route and would safely be able to climb down from there. I could see the steep section from the ledge and saw that the snow had melted away and that it was dry. And I thought that this was something that was totally doable. I could visualize where I needed to go, and the first section wouldn't be too bad. The top section looked a little dicey, but it wasn't anything more than I'd done before. I could see where I needed to be, and if I could just get there, I could get myself out of the situation. I start climbing, and the bottom part is just a large slab of rock, and it's pretty easy to climb up. But the further and further I get up this section, the rockier it gets, and the handholds become more dispersed. I could see that I'm almost to the point of safety, and I just have one last move before I get there. I remember reaching for this last rock and pulling myself up and then feeling the rock come loose. I wake up, and the first thing I notice is that I can't see out of my left eye. I go to reach for it with my left hand, only to see that my wrist is twisted in a way it shouldn't be twisted. And even though I've never broken a bone before, I know that my wrist is broken. And so I try reaching for my eye with my right hand and pull away from my hand, and I look to see that there's a ton of blood. And I look behind me and I see a trail of blood, and I know that I had fallen and I didn't make it to the top. I look down to assess my other injuries, and I see that I have a deep gash in my right knee, and that I have another gash at the top of my left thigh. And there's blood everywhere. I try to turn to look to see where the blood trail starts and realize that I probably have a few broken ribs as well. At that moment, I knew that I had some kind of head injury because I had no idea where I was. But I also knew that I needed to act fast and that I needed to stop the bleeding because I was losing blood really quickly. And so I pulled out the first aid kit and started stuffing gauze in my gashes and then wrapping them up tightly. Once I managed to stop the bleeding, or at least attempt to stop the bleeding, I knew the next thing I needed to do was to get warm. I already could not feel my feet and was shivering, and knew that if the sun shifted, I was about to face a lot colder temperatures. So I grabbed my layers out of my backpack and put all the clothes that I had on. My brother was training to be a doctor in the Air Force and had just completed a wilderness medicine course and had a bunch of emergency Mylar blankets left over and sent me a packet of them. I was really thankful that he had sent me those blankets, even if at the time I didn't understand exactly how grateful I was going to be for them. And I pulled it out of its wrapper and bundled myself up in it. Now that I've stopped the bleeding and made an attempt to get warm, I feel myself starting to get really sleepy and thinking about how easy it would be just to go to sleep. As I find myself drifting closer and closer to sleep, I suddenly hear a loud, high-pitched squeak. And I notice that near my feet is a pika. For those of you who don't know what a pika is, they're a small mammal most closely related to a rabbit that are found in high alpine environments, often in rocks. At this point, I don't know whether or not this pika is real, but its squeak was loud enough to wake me up and made me realize I need to stay awake. I can't go to sleep now. At this point, I'm lying down, and I know I need to readjust and sit up to stay alert and to stay awake. So I grab my backpack and prop it up behind me. And as I grab my backpack, I feel my phone. And at first, I feel a sense of hope. It's my phone. I could try calling out. And then I remembered I had done that already and that I couldn't get service. And so I thought about recording a video for my family and friends to say goodbye. The thought of doing that made me emotional, but with that emotion came a feeling of defiance and a feeling that I was not ready to give up yet. And so I did what most people do in emergency situations. I dialed 911, and of course the call failed. And so I did it again, and again, and again. I had dialed 911 19 times before I got through to anybody. Something that only a desperate person would do. I don't remember really talking to someone on the other end, but I remember the feeling of hearing someone's voice and realizing that someone knew I was out there.
Hello?
Blake County 911.
Hi.
This is Avery.
My phone's about to go dead.
Just take a deep breath for me, Avery, okay?
my soul is about to go down. And I'm going to need a helicopter because I'm on top of a mountain.
I'm here with you, okay?
You guys know where I am?
Yeah, I think we have a good idea. Yeah, we're going to try to make sure that's not here where you're at. We're going to try to ping your phone. Just deep breath for me, okay? Yeah, we're going to do whatever it takes to find you, okay? I promise.
Are you called a dog? Yes, I have.
Okay, can you just... Can you remember anything else about your walk up there? Any landmarks or any signs you saw?
No. No, I didn't. I don't know if I'm gonna make it.
You're gonna make it, I promise. We're gonna find you. You just hang in there, okay? Just be strong and hang in there, okay, Avery? We're gonna come find you and get you out of there, I promise. And Avery, if your battery does die, you don't give up. I want you to know we're gonna come get you. We're gonna get you out of there, okay? Don't ever give up for me, okay? Don't go to sleep. Just stay awake for me, okay?
Don't go to sleep.
You stay strong and you don't give up, you understand? Okay, we're gonna get you home, but you stay strong for me, okay? And if your cell phone dies, don't worry, we know where you're at. We're gonna come get you, okay?
Okay.
Avery, you still there? Avery, you there?
Apparently, I spoke to the emergency responder for almost 40 minutes. And from that conversation, they were able to figure out where I was, even though I couldn't tell them. I really couldn't remember where I was because of my head injury and was trying to give them details about what I could see and where I thought I was. And what I really remember is that I was not sure that they knew where I was. I was sitting there on that ledge, not sure if I was waiting for a helicopter to come and rescue me or if I was just waiting for nothing. And my mind was just racing with all these different thoughts. I remember thinking about the details of what my funeral might be like. What picture would they have? What music would they play? And I also remember feeling very, very guilty for doing this to my family and my friends. Because in my mind, I had chosen to go on this hike, and everything I had done and all the decisions I made led me to where I was at that moment. And that kind of guilt is very difficult to describe. There were moments where the wind sounded like a helicopter, and I could just imagine that I would see one come over the horizon. And then I heard something again, and it was getting louder and louder. And then I looked up above me, and I could see a helicopter. A real helicopter. I just felt so relieved. I knew that I wasn't going to die out here. I see a man being lowered from the helicopter by a cable. And by the time he gets to me, I'm so overwhelmed with emotion that I can't even say anything. I'm just so relieved. And I don't really remember much about being lifted from the mountain and into the helicopter. But there's footage from that rescue, and you can see in the video that I am just smiling because I am so relieved that they found me and that I'm going to be okay. When they lifted me into the helicopter, I remember one of the rescuers telling me if I'd been there another hour, I might not have made it because at that point I was severely hypothermic. At the hospital, I learned that not only did I break my wrist, but I also had broken my kneecap and three ribs and my right eye socket and received over 50 stitches for the various gashes I had on my body. I was actually very lucky with my injuries. My recovery only took about 6 weeks, although the first month of that, I was in a wheelchair. My accident received a lot of media coverage. It was covered on the TV and in the local newspaper. And I remember reading some of the comments from people about how I shouldn't have been doing what I was doing, how I made a lot of wrong decisions, how I was really unprepared. And while I know that the comments sections of local newspapers are not a place where I should take too much sensitivity from, there are some things that I did learn from it. I did not make perfect decisions. There are many places I could have turned around. But in a lot of ways, I was prepared. I told friends where I was going. I had the right equipment, and I had the training. I had taken Wilderness First Responder and kept my certifications up to date. And I had been in many situations where I had to assess risk management. There are just sometimes where you get lucky and sometimes where you don't. What I want people to take away from my story is that a lot of risk can be managed, but there are elements of risk that cannot be controlled. Another question that people ask me a lot about my experience is, how has it changed me? And I struggle to answer this question without sounding cliche, but these feelings are real and they're cliche for a reason. When you have a near-death experience, you do gain a better appreciation for life. And for me, I realized that I began to feel emotions a lot stronger than I did before. So not only was I appreciative of feeling happy during the happy times, but I was also appreciative of sad things that happened because I was grateful to be feeling any feelings at all.
The Boiling River. Microscopic dangers tend to be some of the most overlooked within the pantheon of potentially deadly things out in the natural world. Some are better known, such as the bacteria, viruses, and parasites that you'll find in certain kinds of raw meat or in untreated drinking water, or riding along on ticks and mosquitoes. Others aren't as well publicized. To tell us about one of these lesser-known nasties, here are meat eater videographer Maggie Smith and her boyfriend, Edbo Janae, with a tale that takes place at the Boiling River in Yellowstone National Park. You'll find mentions of this river in accounts by 19th century fur trappers, we call them the mountain men, who used ropes to lower chunks of elk and bighorn meat into the river to cook their dinner in the seismically heated water. A guy recently got thrown out of Yellowstone for trying to replicate the same experiment with a chicken. Maggie and Edbo weren't engaging in any nefarious cooking activities, but they did make a common mistake that wound up having serious consequences.
My name is Edbo Janae.
I am Mary Margaret Smith, or Maggie Smith, or at the office, I am known as Marge. I am a videographer here at Meat Eater.
And you're my girlfriend.
And yes, this is my lovely boyfriend, Edbo. We've been together for 7 years.
So about 3 years ago, we took an overnight trip over to Yellowstone. We finished the day in the Boiling River, where a hot springs blows into the river, which is otherwise cold. It's kind of like a natural jacuzzi hot springs type thing. It's about a mile hike to get back into where you get into the water. So while we were hanging out back there, I looked at Maggie and I said, "Maggie, time me." And I dunked my head underwater.
This is like one of Edbo's, I don't know if you can call it a hobby, an interest, holding his breath is something he's into.
I like to swim. Yeah, it's a practical skill to have, I think. The next day was a work day just like any other. We woke up and went to work. But that morning when I woke up, Maggie looked at me and I had a shiner.
It wasn't huge, but it was odd. It looked like you had dark purple eyeshadow, you know, painted under your eye.
It looked like something had happened. It was clearly bruised. Maggie was pretty concerned. It didn't look too serious that day. But then we woke up the next day on Tuesday, and it looked like I had been punched in the face.
Yeah, what had gone from just like a small kind of patch under your eye from around your tear duct had just spread to the whole shebang. It was vibrant and nasty looking.
You were very concerned. I still was not as concerned as I should have been. But I made an appointment with the eye doctor, and they took a look at it, and they said, hey, man, something hit you. This is trauma to your eye. You have a black eye.
We knew that wasn't the case. I was in disbelief that that's what they said.
Yeah, we were pretty confident that that was not the case. Thursday, it looked even worse. By Friday of that week, it had gotten pretty bad. I couldn't see out of that eye. It was pretty obvious that something bad was going on. And then on Sunday morning, I woke up and my other eye was starting to change colors too. So now I had one eye that looked like I'd gotten punched and it was swollen shut, and the other one was starting to change colors. So I called the eye doctor that I had seen previously, and he was like, dude, go to the ER. We don't know what's going on anymore. This is serious. So we go to the ER and we're checking in, and the intake nurse takes one look at me and says, someone punched you in the face. Your girlfriend probably elbowed you while you were sleeping. And I looked over at Maggie and I thought she was going to strangle this woman. I didn't know what was going to happen.
That is the truth. I was furious.
You were very mad. So then we got through to see the eye specialist. And he came out and he took one look at me and he was freaking out. I could tell that he was very concerned.
Yeah, you know when you go to a doctor and doctor's always cool, calm, collected? I mean, that's part of their job. He was sweating.
He was sweating bullets.
I have never seen a doctor just sweat so profusely in my life. I almost wanted to hand him a towel, but I didn't have one. So that made us nervous then.
That did. It made us very nervous. And then he pulled out this implement that measures how far your eyeball is protruding from your head. And apparently the eye that had been swollen shut was protruding very far out of my head, which concerned him very much.
I don't remember how far, but it was an alarming amount. I mean, you could see it at this point. Your eye was not level from the side. It was sticking out.
Yeah, it looked pretty bad.
Yeah.
For the first 3 days, they had no idea what was going on. At one point, the doctor came in at 11 o'clock at night and said, look, man, I don't want to leave any stone unturned. We're going to test you for HIV and AIDS. And I was like, what in the hell? So I laid there awake all night reading WebMD with my one good eye that I could still see out of, convinced that I had HIV. And it was just getting worse. Those first 3 nights, it was getting worse and worse and worse to the point where both of my eyes were swelling shut. By the third day, it felt like someone had put hot coals on my eye sockets. I mean, it hurt bad. But the freakiest thing was that we had all these doctors coming in and out, and they couldn't tell us what was going on.
And they were taking blood out of you like, man, like leeches.
I think it was 60 tests that they ran on just all sorts of crazy bacterias and viruses and anything they could think of they were testing me for.
Things got pretty scary. Like, I was on the phone with your mom and dad. They were trying to figure out if they were going to fly out.
Yeah, they had a helicopter reserved for me to fly me to Salt Lake City because there's apparently a better infectious disease hospital there.
Because it was getting so bad to the point where the eye specialist was like, you know, I want to save your vision, obviously, but our first priority right now is your brain. And like that put it into perspective on how serious this was getting. The infection was in that tissue that was so close to your brain. They were like, we're more concerned with that than you being able to see.
Yeah, they made it pretty clear. If this thing keeps progressing in the way it is, you're going to go blind and then you're going to go brain dead.
Yes.
The whole reason that they couldn't get it dialed in, there was a doctor that works at that hospital who is a wizard with this kind of stuff. It just so happened that the day that I went in there was the start of his weekend. And he does not take phone calls on his weekend. Otherwise, the guy would never have a day off. But then, that fourth day, the head of the infectious disease department, like a wizard, he came in and knew exactly what was going on, took one look at me and said, "This is post-orbital cellulitis." I didn't see him sweat at all. He was cool as a cucumber.
Yeah, no, he was like, I don't know, a wallflower almost. I don't know how to describe him. Like, he didn't have like a huge presence to him, but he just came in and looked at you and was like, yep, this is what I think this is. Go ahead with the steroid.
Yeah. He rattled off a steroid antibiotic cocktail and said, give him this. And it cleared up pretty quick after that. It really was not...
The swelling just went down. Just
swelling went down rapidly.
It's like a balloon deflating almost.
Yeah. My eyes started to open. I could see again. And he is like, so what have you been doing? Did you go swimming recently? When I told him that I had swam in the boiling river, he was like, bingo. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's where it came from.
And he was pretty certain. And then after all this, what did he tell you about his like for hot tubs and hot springs?
Oh, yeah. He said that he will not go into a hot tub or a hot spring, especially if it's at a hotel.
So just note, infectious disease doctor says to stay away from all hot water, basically.
Ultimately, with the proper diagnosis, the infection was easy to treat. But the reason it took so long for Edbo to get that diagnosis is that cellulitis usually presents as a skin or soft tissue infection near an opened flesh wound. Many of us are more familiar with the version of cellulitis that's commonly called flesh-eating disease or necrotizing fasciitis. This type of infection is usually the result of waterborne pathogens entering the body through an open flesh wound, and it can become fatal if the victim isn't quickly and aggressively treated with antibiotics. Knocked down by an alien. Now, on to Mount Vernon, South Dakota, a town that's well known for being a prime pheasant hunting spot. Although pheasant hunters often hunt alongside specially trained bird dogs, they also use a technique known as a drive or a push, which involves a large group of hunters arranged in a formation designed to flush out the birds. You've got pushers or drivers walking through a field or other piece of habitat with the objective of scaring game toward hunters, called blockers. The blockers are positioned on the far end of the field, where they wait for a chance to take a shot at a flying bird. The last piece of the puzzle are the flankers, who are posted along the outside edges of the field to try to cut off any pheasants that try to squirt out the sides of the formation. This type of pheasant hunting can be very effective, but there are risks. Occasionally, you'll hear of harmless incidents that involve a hunter getting lightly peppered by shotgun pellets fired from a long distance away. But there have been much more serious injuries. You have a number of hunters concentrated in a relatively small area, and some of them may be so focused on trying to hit a flushed bird that they fail to pay attention to the positions of the other hunters. Neither of these scenarios is what befell Chad Converse, our narrator, while he was pheasant hunting in Mount Vernon. What actually happened was much less expected.
It was the last day of the hunt. We were hunting in very tall cornfields. The corn was probably 5 to 7 foot tall, and we would have four blockers at the far end of the field to stop the birds from flushing out on that end. And then we'd run with two flankers that worked about 50 yards ahead of the group. It was actually the first bird I had shot, and was in the middle of reloading my shotgun, and I noticed a lot of the dogs were running past me towards where I had downed the bird, and that's when I just got smashed by something. I had no idea what it was. I just got slammed to the ground. The first initial reaction to how much my face was bleeding and how bad it hurt, and all my teeth were broken, I was like, holy cow, I just got shot. But then I had realized, like, I didn't hear, like, the whiz of all the BBs flying by. It didn't sound like a swarm of bees hitting, like, all over the corn plus me. Like, it was very acute in one small area, which, like, a shotgun would not do unless you're at extreme close ranges. So I kind of thought maybe one of the dogs, when it was running to get the birds, kind of sideswiped me. But that didn't really make sense of why my face was bleeding so bad. Well, maybe I smashed my face, like, on the rib of the shotgun, and that's what cut me open. And I started trying to look around, and I couldn't find my shotgun anywhere. My face is bleeding like a faucet. All the guys are coming around me. The ground looks like someone just, you know, opened up a gallon jug and is spraying blood on the ground or with a hose. I knew I was in bad shape. I didn't know how bad, but I knew I wasn't doing awesome. And I definitely was slightly more concerned when I started seeing everyone's looks on their face. Like, I could tell it wasn't a pretty picture. They loaded me up in the vehicle. The lodge owner's wife was actually a nurse. She had some, like, gauze in the vehicle. So I'm trying to control my bleeding and bleed into, like, the gauze in the box. But it's just filling up my mouth and nose is just filling up with saliva and blood. And I could not hear out of my right ear very well. I was actually in the military, and we had gotten hit by an IED one time in a convoy. And one of my buddies took some shrapnel through kind of like his lower jaw area. And so I knew that that was all kind of connected because he had to go see a ear, throat, and nose specialist due to that. And so as we're driving, I'm just thinking, oh man, I got all these injuries and now I'm going to lose hearing out of this ear. I can't hear at all. And I just happened to kind of look up in the rearview mirror and I noticed some like pink stuff come out of my ear. I was like, oh great, now I'm leaking like brain fluid or something. I'm going to be really jacked up. And I reached up there to go touch that fluid, and it just happened to be an earplug. So I flicked the earplug out, and I could hear again. So that was a huge sigh of relief in that quick moment. We get to the hospital. The nurses and the staff is asking me, like, what had happened. And like I had mentioned earlier, I ran through several scenarios in my mind, and I could not figure out what happened. I had no clues. Like, as far as I was concerned, I just got blasted from outer space by something.
I'm going to jump in here momentarily for the big reveal. You might remember from the top of the story that Chad mentioned they had four blockers at the end of the field and some flankers working 50 yards ahead of the group of pushers. Well, when Chad got out from getting his x-rays, he received a phone call from one of the flankers who'd been on the edge of the field. While there were no witnesses to the actual event, the flanker said that he'd seen a white-tailed buck tearing out of the field right about the time Chad went down. So what they deduced was that Chad's gunshot, or perhaps the actions of another hunter, had scared the buck. The unexplained impact that toppled him over was the force of the buck colliding with Chad at full speed and ramming his antlers straight into the side of Chad's face. The corn was so tall and thick that no one saw the buck coming or going until he exited the field. And the buck probably didn't see Chad until it was too late. Another thing to note is that the impact of the collision was so intense that it launched Chad's shotgun 25 feet. That's why he couldn't find it when he was initially trying to figure out what had knocked him over. Now, back to Chad.
I was popping Percocets or whatever pain medicine they were giving me, like Pez, basically. And it's not hardly putting a dent in this thing. My face is super swollen, can't quit, like, drooling out of myself, blood leaking. And at this point, all the good meds from the hospital are starting to kind of wear off. And I go to take a pain pill. And when I did that, is when I could feel everything in my face and skull like moving around as I tried to swallow. And it hurt like crazy. I ended up getting 4 plates, 27 screws, and 2 wires in my face. I have a plate and screws in my arm from a fast roping incident when I was in the Army. The impact or the fall fractured my arm right at the end of that plate. Then they took out the plate and screws in my arm and put in a longer, thinner plate and more screws. When that antler deflected off my tooth and went basically kind of like through my cheek area. It severed the saliva gland and the saliva ductwork, if you will. They put a stent in that gland and then a port basically out of the bottom of my neck for the excess saliva to leak out, which is attractive as it sounds. Felt pretty meek and weak for a long time. I was like 190 at the time, so I dropped down to 160. Lost 30 pounds sitting on my butt doing nothing, so it's a pretty effective diet if anyone's interested. I found it pretty funny that people kept asking me if I was like done hunting or if I was scared to ever go hunting again. And honestly, it never even crossed my mind. Like, I was excited to go hunting again. The way I looked at it is it was a 1 in a billion odds. If it does happen again, 1 in a billion, then I don't know. That's just maybe God's calling me home and it's time to go. I don't know, but it's worth the roll of dice for me.
Clearly, this isn't your typical pheasant hunting injury story. The odds that Chad would be precisely positioned so as to take a buck's antler to the face in the manner that would require multiple surgeries and many weeks on a liquid diet are, as Chad told us, probably 1 in a billion. But wild animals are very unpredictable, especially when they're scared or surprised. Things could certainly have turned out worse, and Chad was back outside in the woods before it was even medically advisable for him to do so. There's a bit of poetic justice in the fact that the following year, a guy who had the hunting rights to that particular property managed to kill the buck that ran Chad over. The antlers made their way to Chad and now sit in a prime position on his desk. The Blackout and the Cave. These next two tales, from Greg Fonts and Alex Renault, are spearfishing stories. It's a discipline that involves free diving underwater while holding your breath, hunting around for a fish, shooting the fish with a spear gun, and then kicking back up to the surface with the fish tussling on the end of the spear shaft. And then, finally, you can take another breath. I've had the privilege of spending some time in the water with Greg and Alex. We were off the coast of California. And being a novice spear fisherman myself, my head went immediately to the risk of great white sharks. Greg and Alex were kind enough to redirect my attention toward the real risks involved, which have to do with managing your oxygen use in combination with exertion and the changes that happen in your lungs under the pressure of deep water.
You get in the water, and you transition from this busy day-to-day life of business and family and traffic. And after 15 or 20 minutes in the ocean, it's an amazingly peaceful place.
It's almost like a meditation. You don't think about anything else. Your one worry is, you know, your body breathing up, slowing everything down, and immersing yourself in the ocean. And once you do that, you learn how responsive everything is to you. In the scheme of things, freediving can be an extremely safe sport. Unfortunately, when accidents do happen, many times they're final and they end up in a fatality situation. So doing the sport alone is very, very dangerous. I've had my share of close calls. I've had a close call in East Africa getting pulled down by a tuna that I got wrapped around my leg. I've been knocked off the side of my boat in NorCal trying to get into it by a big great white shark. I've been chased by bull sharks coming off the bottom in South Africa. This story I'm about to tell is definitely the closest I've come to not coming back.
My name is Alex Renault. I'm a spear fisherman and a member of the 2014 U.S. National Spearfishing Team.
My name is Greg Fonts. I've spearfished for about 20 years now, and I'm a member of the Louisiana Hell Divers, a world team member for Peru 2014, national team champion, and freedive instructor. One of the areas that I liked to explore early on in my spearfishing is an island called Saravo Island. It's an 18-mile island off of the east coast of Baja Sur. We're about 4 days into this trip. The fishing wasn't very good, to be honest with you. It was the reef fishing was really, really hard. Everything had pushed out deep because of the water temps. But we had finally found this reef, a good scattered reef that was holding fish. There was only two of us in the water at the time. And, you know, one of the big things that we violated, we were diving the same general reef, but separate. My buddy and I started together and kind of drifted away from each other, and that naturally kind of happens with the current and everything else. I breathe up, I drop down, find the reef, and then I do start my espeto, just laying there, kind of letting stuff come in. An espeto is basically a dive that you kick to the bottom and lay there. You just lay there motionless and let the reef settle down and the fish come into you. About a minute and a half after I started my dive, I wasn't seeing anything. It's a couple days in and I'm feeling kind of tired at that time of the day. So I start kicking up and I get to about, you know, a little deeper than 50 feet, somewhere in there. And at this point I saw a really, really big Pargoa Maria. So stopped me in my tracks and I did a big no-no, which is I turned around on my dive. I had a few contractions, but I was feeling, you know, rather comfortable. The problem is if you get more experience, you have learned how to put up with your diaphragm spasming. Your breathing reflexes is one of your strongest things that the body wants to do. And to tell it that it doesn't want to breathe, and you build up this tolerance to diaphragm spasms is something that you really need to watch. So I kick back down to somewhere a little over 80 feet. I wasn't on the bottom, but I was pretty close to it. So I shoot the fish, and I stone it, which when you stone a fish, you're basically hitting it in the spine or the brain, and you're instantly killing the fish. It doesn't even move its fins. It drops underneath the ledge and gets stuck. So I'm kicking up, and I'm trying to yank this fish with my shooting line to get it off the ledge. But at that point, I'm kind of like, you know, I should probably get to the surface and reapproach this whole deal. The worst things you can do is come up and then return back down to the bottom or return for a fish and then kick back up. You're exerting a lot of energy at the very end of your dive. And that's one of the most dangerous things you really can do is push yourself when your O2 levels already are taxed. Once your lungs start expanding, that's when you start running into problems. So I release my gun with my right hand. I look down on my right hip, which I have my belt reel on my right hip all the time. I let go. I just remember going, oh, fuck. And realizing that my gun wasn't hooked up, and that is the last thing I remember. It's like someone just flipped a switch. I wake up on the surface convulsing, and it's a full body convulsion. My arms are out to my sides. I'm making this weird whooping noise, which is, it's kind of weird what you remember when something like this happens, like the weird little details you remember. But I remember my arms being out to my sides, convulsing, making this whooping noise, which, you know, is basically my body trying to force air out to get another breath in. Had no clue really what had happened, but you know, I got a big breath of air and suddenly